Accessibility Craft Podcast, where we explore the art of creating accessible websites while trying out interesting craft beverages. This podcast is brought to you by the team at Equalize Digital, a WordPress accessibility company and the proud creators of the Accessibility Checker plugin. And now, on to the show.
Chris is a product manager who is deeply passionate about delivering valuable products to customers. He's a lover of gadgets, tea, Apple products, board games, old jazz, and blues albums, comic books, accessible products, and delightful UX. We are very excited to have you here to speak.
Well, good morning, everyone. I am very excited to be here. Thank you for joining. As an unplanned thing, I wanted to give a special shout out. I saw in chat Brenda was joining from Madison, Wisconsin. I don't know Brenda, but I am in Madison, Wisconsin, so a special hello. I'm excited to be here talking about WCAG and thinking beyond just compliance and digital accessibility. As we said, my name is Chris Schultens. I'm a director of product management at Engels Video. My background is in user experience, design, and research before moving over to product management, but I've always had a strong passion for accessibility. So today, well, why are we here? I think the biggest thing is I love to point out over 96% of the world's top 1 million web pages are not accessible. And that means we have a lot of work to do to help users access the products and services and content that they need to help navigate their lives. Today, we'll start by looking at the foundations. We can't go beyond standards and compliance if we don't understand them and meet them first. And then we will look beyond compliance at some practical examples of going beyond the WCAG criteria. We'll also talk about performative accessibility and what that means. Next, we'll talk about accessibility's broader impact on organizations and companies. And finally, we'll talk about how to begin. So, what are the foundations of making accessible products and services? Why do we do it, and why do we care? Well, as Steve Krug says, the one argument for accessibility that doesn't get made nearly often enough is how extraordinarily better it makes some people's lives. How many opportunities do we have to dramatically improve people's lives just by doing our job a little bit better? Disability impacts all of us. The World Health Organization estimates that 1.3 billion people experience significant disability. That's about 1 in 6 people. Now, the categories on the screen right now of disabilities, including cognitive, mobility, auditory, visual, speech, and psychological disabilities, these are not an exhaustive list by any means. It's just representative of the breadth of disability that could impact a user. Because disability impacts all of us, many countries and regions around the world have created legal standards for making various products and services accessible to all users. Now, we can run around trying to make sure that we're focused on compliance with one legal standard or another, but luckily for all of us, almost all of these legal requirements point back to a version of the WCAG standards, meaning we can focus our efforts there. Just as a side note, I will be saying WCAG for the acronym WCAG. I know there are different ways that different people might pronounce that, just so you know. So why WCAG? For many of you, this may be a review of information you already know. But the World Wide Web Consortium created a single shared standard for individuals, organizations, and governments with testable success criteria that divide into 13 guidelines and 4 organizing principles: perceivable, operable, understandable, and robust. The standards have also been updated over time, allowing us to know that our digital content is accessible to all users. And we are currently on version 2.2 of WCAG that was introduced a little over a year ago. So why isn't WCAG our end goal? Well, the guidelines are an important baseline, but just meeting them doesn't ensure the most accessible experience for our users. In fact, being solely focused on that compliance can limit how much we can help our users access our products. So how do we look beyond compliance? As Ron Kaufman says, exceeding expectations is where satisfaction ends and loyalty begins. In the many conversations I've had about accessibility over the years, we often fall short when talking about accessibility, accessible design, accessible development. All too often, accessibility is a checkbox. Did we hit the standards? You know, fly the mission accomplished banner. Or maybe we only care about accessibility so that we can meet a requirement for sales on an RFP or a tender. Our product is accessible, whatever that means to that customer. Or maybe you hear the common refrain that I've heard time and time again. Well, accessibility takes more time and more money, and we will absolutely be talking about that a little bit later. Or maybe you have, you know, people building your product that are very well intentioned and they're thinking about accessibility and, you know, they're taking kind of the first steps. Okay, I know my images have alt tags. My color contrast ratios are good. Maybe we're even using some ARIA elements, but that's not the end of the story. Or maybe you're at an organization that actually cares about the WCAG standards, but all too often, they may be focused on making their product or service perceivable and operable and not giving as much attention to understandable or robust. And of course, users with different disabilities don't get the same attention. Somebody that has ADHD may have a harder time understanding long-form content. Someone with dyslexia may have a harder time perceiving text-based content. The single best thing that you can do is do real-world testing with users with disabilities. I'm going to be saying that a lot today. So WCAG is not our end goal. What do we do? Invest in novel ways to improve accessibility. Focus on the difficulties that your users with various disabilities may face, and these can be unearthed through your real-world testing. Think about how you can make your content more perceivable, more operable, understandable, and more robust, not just some subset of that. So at this point, I'd love to dive into practical examples. I would love to hear or see in chat, what are some ways that you have made your product more accessible in novel ways? Or maybe what are some ways that you've seen another product be more accessible to users? Just adding headings makes a big difference. Absolutely. More white space. Yeah, it just the, you know, kind of joining those two together, just the way that things are presented visually is extremely important. Drag and drop, bigger font, descriptions to images, increasing target size. Yeah, all of these are fantastic. So I'm going to dive into some practical examples that I have seen, that I have worked on implementing myself, and talk about the good and the bad of them. So one common way that I see of making a product more accessible is by introducing themes. Light mode, dark mode are becoming very, very common, with high contrast, somewhat less common. And this allows users to select their preference, which really does improve accessibility and usability. I will note, I keep hearing this myth that dark mode is inherently good for accessibility because it improves the text readability. That's not always true. I recommend a true high contrast theme for that specific reason. It has the highest contrast ratios. and is really designed to be the most legible, the most readable for users with visual disabilities. Dyslexia-friendly font options. There are fonts like Dyslexia or Open Dyslexic that are designed to be more readable for individuals with dyslexia. The letters are given more visual weight at the bottom to help users quickly figure out which which letter a given letter is. It helps in recognition. Now, I will say the research about the effectiveness of these fonts is a bit mixed, and certainly color can play an important factor as well, but offering users choice can improve accessibility for that individual. The Color ADD language. This is a language of symbols to help identify colors. It allows individuals with visual disabilities to identify and engage in items where color carries informational significance. And that means the specific color of something is important to what it is trying to do. The example on screen here is a Rubik's Cube. Obviously, if I am a person with color blindness, Rubik's Cube is going to be very difficult for me. That being said, this color ADD language is a universal set of symbols that allows me to identify the colors and be able to engage with a particular piece of information. And this is comes out of Portugal, but it has been adopted in a number of places around the world. There are Rubik's Cubes, there are Uno sets. I have seen subway maps even adopting this language to offer an alternative means of conveying the information. So it is certainly, a unique tool that is available for offering an alternative means of getting the necessary information across. A while ago, someone mentioned to me that QR codes improve accessibility. I had honestly never thought about them in the context of accessibility, but when I did actually think about it, it really can be something to help improve accessibility. If a user has a hard time entering in a long web address, scanning a QR code can save time or even make a task possible that wasn't before. But QR codes can also present challenges for users with visual or motor disabilities. Offering QR codes as an option, not the only way, again, provides a more flexible, accessible solution. And for anyone that's following along, the QR code that is on screen right now does lead directly to the WCAG 2.2 standards. I don't often hear translation brought up in the context of accessibility, but offering content in a user's preferred language or their native language does improve usability and accessibility as well. So we should all rush out and implement all of the things that I've just presented today, all of the things from chat, right? Well, let's talk about performative accessibility. Kevin DeYoung says, I try to keep in mind the simple question, am I trying to do good or am I trying to make myself look good? What is performative accessibility? Well, it boils down to doing something for how it looks. Did you add a feature to improve accessibility because it helps your users or because it makes you look good and you can pat yourself on the back with a nice article on LinkedIn? It gets back to making sure your foundation is secure first and then building from there. And I will be the first to admit it can be a difficult tightrope walk. There's a reason I mentioned the downsides of some of the previous practical examples. But ultimately, for both the user and the organization, it's better when things are more accessible. So what does doing it right look like? Well, listen to your users, test with real users with disabilities. There is no substitute for that. Make sure your foundation is secure. When you can make it happen, which it can be hard to find time, budget, resources to get buy-in from leadership, et cetera, have your product audited for accessibility compliance by an independent third party. That gives legitimacy to your claims for, you know, your strong foundation and lets you know you're ready to invest in novel solutions. At this point, I would hope that this audience is bought into going beyond WeK. If you're here at a WordPress meetup on accessibility, you probably didn't need a whole lot of convincing. This is better for users. But what about the broader picture? What does this mean for your organization? As the Dalai Lama says, everything you do has some effect, some impact. Everyone knows building and developing more accessible products only costs more time and money, right? Well, that's not always true. In my earliest days fighting for accessibility, I often got buy-in when I could get it solely to avoid negative consequences. The we don't want to get sued, or we just need it to win a customer deal. When I would try to request time or budget or staff or other resources to improve accessibility beyond that, it was really an uphill battle. In reality, building and developing accessible products and services has positive benefit for organizations. It can drive innovation, it increases market reach, it can foster brand loyalty, and it can create a culture of empathy. These are the arguments that are going to help make your case when you are requesting resources to do more. But I will say, if you can only get buy-in to improve accessibility to avoid a negative consequence, still take it. It is better than not being given anything to improve accessibility. As an example of accessibility driving innovation, look at closed captions. Closed captions started as a capability for TV viewers with auditory disabilities to watch TV, but they have been widely adopted across many different industries and all uses of video. Even our meetup today is being live captioned. I can't remember the last time I watched a TV show without the captions turned on. Or take a look at late night TV. Many of the products that you see in infomercials came to life as an accessible art alternative. Here in the United States, a really popular example is the Snuggie. It's a blanket with sleeves. It seems kind of gimmicky and silly until you realize it was designed for wheelchair users, but they've become popular with the market in general. So accessibility design and development is not a time and a money sink. It truly improves products and the organizations who make them. So now we're all bought in and we've convinced our leadership to buy in to improving accessibility beyond just meeting the standards. So where do we begin? The great Muhammad Ali said, "Even the greatest was once a beginner. Don't be afraid to take that first step."
This episode of Accessibility Craft is sponsored by Equalized Digital Accessibility Checker, the WordPress plugin that helps you find accessibility problems before you hit publish. Thousands of businesses, nonprofits, universities, and government agencies around the world trust Accessibility Checker to help their teams find, fix, and prevent accessibility problems on an ongoing basis. New to accessibility? Equalized Digital Accessibility Checker is here to teach you every step of the way. Whether you're a content creator or a developer, our detailed documentation guides you through fixing accessibility issues. Never lose track of accessibility again with real-time scans each time you save, powerful reports inside the WordPress dashboard, and a front-end view to help you track down hard-to-find issues. Scan unlimited posts and pages with Accessibility Checker free. Upgrade to Accessibility Checker Pro to scan your website in bulk, whether it has 10 pages or 10,000. Download Accessibility Checker today at equalizeddigital.com/accessibility-checker. Use coupon code ACCESSIBILITYCRAFT to save 10% on any plan.
Like the old joke says, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. You just have to start. The same is true for accessibility. hopefully I can help you avoid some common mistakes along the way. I want to be very clear, no product is ever perfectly accessible. So make small improvements over time. Don't wait for your product to be perfect. There is no magic solution because accessibility is a program of improvement, not a project with a finish line. And last but not least, you can't do this all on your own. Whether you have a team or coworkers or a cohort or people in meetups like this, someone can help you. Going alone will lead to burnout. Make improvements where you can. Put in the work of designing and developing and testing every step of the way. So where do we start? Start with others. Can you take advantage of a plugin or a library? Obviously, our hosts today have a wonderful plugin for WordPress. There are plugins for WordPress. There are plugins and libraries outside of WordPress as well that can help improve your accessibility. I will add the caveat, not all plugins are created equal, so please do your research. Make sure your foundation is rock solid. Use automated testing to identify potential issues. Get an audit done. I will say existing digital footprints, if you have a product or service that is already out in the world, can have hundreds, maybe thousands of websites, millions of web pages. That's why audits use a representative sample. It's impossible to manually test every single page. And honestly, it's not always necessary. That's why it's important to build websites on a stable foundation. So make sure your templates or your design systems, make sure those are accessible. They make creating and auditing your content significantly easier. Lastly, listen to your users. They know when they find something frustrating or unusable. Test with real users with disabilities. I will say it again and again. I know I sound like a broken record, but it is the most important thing you can do. As a side note, I'm just kind of thinking of this right now. What's a good aphorism that modernizes the phrase broken record? Because I don't know that is universal anymore. If and when you do come up with novel solutions, verify and test them with your users. And then come and tell me so I can learn too. I think that's self-serving, but I absolutely want to know, what are you doing out there? I want to leave you with this thought. Accessibility is a journey. We have to embrace a spirit of continual improvement, challenging ourselves to do more to serve our users' needs. We have to start with empathy and grow through innovation so that we can shape products that genuinely enhance the lives of those we serve. And at this point, I'm ready to open it up for our questions.
Great. Sorry, it always takes me a minute to find myself again. I am going to go through questions. If anyone has any questions for Chris, please post them in the Q&A and I will pass them along. I did want to touch a little bit because there was some conversation in the chat about the tools recommendations and plugins and all of that kind of stuff versus overlays. I think it's always worth mentioning here, if you're not familiar with an accessibility overlay, those are the things that add the toolbars kind of on the front end that allow users to modify your website. I always recommend looking at the overlayfactsheet.com to get a lot of information about that. And I love, Chris, how you were saying what's really important is anytime you put a tool on your website, you have to have users test it. And I'm wondering if you want to expand on that a little bit and why that's important.
Yeah. So I have learned, take my successes where I can get them. And automated testing was how I started with making sure we were compliant and accessible. But you realize pretty quickly into that, not everything can be caught by an automated test, especially if you are not a user with disabilities. You don't perceive things in the same way. I am not a native screen reader software user, but I have, at this point, you know, many, many, many hours of using screen reader software. I still don't experience using screen reader software the same way that somebody that uses it natively does. They experience different pain points than I can identify in automated testing. So just because of the complete difference in it, how something is perceived and experienced is between a, I hate this word, but normal user.
Typical is what I like to use.
Typical, yes, that's a much better word. Thank you. Typical user and someone with disabilities, you can't account for that in every automated test. That being said, automated testing is getting better and better, but it's not a replacement, especially if you're testing with users of your product or service. They already know it and can identify where they have pain points. So that is better than a generic test.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a big thing for us because we went back and forth on this. We're going to build a testing tool. And how do we have all of our language and all of our reports? We ended up putting this thing that's like 100% pass tests does not mean 100% accessible. Because I was like, you know, sometimes people see those scores and they think, oh, it's perfect. But you're right. You really do need to include real users of assistive technology. I loved Andy posted a comment in the chat that said accessibility is a journey. If you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together, which is an African proverb.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. I'm going to work through some of the questions that we have here. Jude said, I'd really love to hear your perspective regarding the European Accessibility Act in 2025, and what should US-based companies be aware of from either a compliance or non-compliance perspective? And we're going to start this off with, you are not an attorney, correct?
Absolutely not.
So we're going to give advice, neither am I. We're going to give some advice and opinions as web professionals. This is not legal advice, but go ahead.
Yeah. So as a non-lawyer, my interpretation of the law is, as far as standards and compliance, it is still referring back to WCAG standards. That's where our focus should be. The one additional piece is requiring a statement from products that wish to be compliant. That is, in my understanding, a little bit of a minefield right now, because each country in the EU can kind of establish their own interpretation of what that needs to be. So I think it's honestly still a bit of a moving target, but from what we can do, make sure we have our foundations rock solid, that we are fully compliant. And honestly, I recommend when I'm doing consultation, make sure you're compliant with the WCAG 2.2 standards. I know a lot of things point back to 2.0 or 2.1, but do yourself a favor and do a little bit of future proofing. That's where the most effort and the most current research into what actually makes things accessible and usable has been put.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And my understanding is, in many ways, this is going to be like GDPR was for privacy. So even if your business is not located in Europe, if you sell products to customers in Europe or you advertise in Europe, right, then the law might start applying to you. So even if you are a US-based company, if you have a European market, then you need to pay attention to the European Accessibility Act. And the threshold for that is 10 employees or more, or 2 million euros in turnover. So revenue. Adrian said, you mentioned translation to a person's preferred language. Is letting the browser auto-translate to the user's preferred language acceptable, especially if you have a wide range of international visitors from diverse language backgrounds? Adrian says, I think many translation plugins are no better and possibly worse. Do you have more thoughts on this, translating to different languages?
Yeah, so I will give the classic answer. It depends. Realistically, when I am viewing products or websites from countries or languages that are not my primary language, and they offer an auto-translate, more often than not, it can lead me to being frustrated because it's close but not quite, and it doesn't make my experience better. It can actually make it a little bit worse. But if it's done well, I really appreciate that and really value it. And from, you know, a business perspective, I am much more likely to spend my time and my money on something that I have a good experience with. So it really depends on the quality of translation that you're getting out. I agree that many automated translation tools are probably not good enough. The products that I work on, we do defend the need to have a dedicated budget for doing professional translation because we see the most value out of that.
Yeah, I've had a few customers even here in the United States where they know that they might have large Spanish speaking or Chinese speaking populations, particularly in like health. In certain parts of the country, and they're typically bringing in a vendor to translate videos, actually the spoken audio of the video, and then also provide captions and transcripts for the videos in those alternative languages. But with WordPress Accessibility Day videos, we aren't translating the spoken audio, but we've decided to get humans to translate the captions, so you could at least read it in your own language if you wanted to help support listening, or you could mute maybe. But I don't know if you have thoughts on that, especially from like a video perspective.
Yeah, caption. So, I mean, working for a video company, I have lots of thoughts on captions. And, you know, there are really two different subsets of that: real-time transcription and then kind of on-demand after the fact. What I have found through research is that in real time, users seem to be a little more willing to accept slightly lower accuracy. That being said, it can't just be wildly inaccurate. You know, it's still in the ballpark of accurate. You can understand what is going on. For on-demand or kind of, you know, non-real-time captioning, there does seem to be an expectation that this is 95, 97% accurate. You know, there are still some tolerance for, you know, not being 100% accurate, because we understand that, you know, in the day we live in, a lot of things are AI or machine captions, but even humans, when they're captioning something, still make occasional mistakes. I think, especially when you get into offering a caption in multiple languages so that the user can choose, again, what language they would like to engage with, you get more flexibility for what inaccuracy will be accepted during live, but for that kind of after the fact on demand, you need to be equally accurate in all of the languages that you present.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the translation, going back to Adrian's question, the maybe allowing auto translation via a browser which means putting nothing on a website might potentially be sufficient if it's not your key audience. But for sure, if it's a language that is primary or on videos, you definitely want to have accurate transcripts. It sounds like what you're saying in captions.
Yes. And I just saw in chat, someone said, this gets back to my point of needing human testing. I can't tell you for your specific product without any more information that, yes, an automated translation is or isn't acceptable to your users. You can try it out, and if it meets their needs in testing, that's great. It's probably a significantly lower time and expense to do translation that way and to improve your usability and your accessibility. But that being said, it might not as well.
Yeah. So Meryl Evans is here, who she's a accessibility specialist who is also deaf. And she had put a couple of comments in the chat as well. And this one I thought was interesting. She talking about what you were saying about real time versus pre-recorded or live versus pre-recorded. And she said, just one word wrong in a sentence in captions can really throw off a viewer, but it's also speed versus accuracy for live. And she said that when she is speaking as a deaf speaker, I prefer automatic captions if she's on a panel or speaking, because the speed can sometimes be faster than a live captioner.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting to add. I'm kind of going on these by upvote order, just so people know. So we had someone ask, if you were starting to build your website today and wanted it to be accessible as a small business, what would you recommend? This person said they want to try and get buy-in from smaller clients. So maybe they're a web developer. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah. I would say you're likely not building a website from scratch. You're probably starting with some sort of template. If you're a small business, make sure a template that you're choosing is accessible to start with. That's going to be the biggest amount of payoff for the smallest amount of investment, basically. Outside of that, just the same thing that I will keep reiterating is, as soon as you have even designs, start putting it in front of users for testing. Between starting with something that's known to be accessible and doing testing with users, I think that will get you a long ways towards your goal.
Yeah. If you look, for the person who asked this, if you look in the meetup recordings, there's a talk that Jen Harris gave, where she talked about doing it on a budget. And one of the things that she said, because she works with a lot of very lower budget micro businesses, and she had shared that she just limits their options. So for example, she just tells them, we don't put carousels on website, because she knows there's not a good accessible out of the box accessibility carousel. And it becomes more expensive if she has to go fix whichever one they want to use. So really, like, figuring out what you're, like you were saying, your template and what components you're willing to use can really reduce costs on building out accessibly, I think. So I'd recommend looking for that. I think maybe Paula might be able to find a link. Evan said, great talk. You mentioned that no product is ever perfectly accessible. What would you say to prospective clients who come to you asking for guaranteed accessibility or perfect WCAG compliance? And I think that Lilani's question is a good follow-up on this, which says, since it is a process and nothing is fail-proof, how can you defend yourself? So what do you say if someone says they want perfect accessibility or 100% compliance?
I'm not a lawyer, so I would not be defending myself in court necessarily, but what I would help equip a lawyer with is showing documentation. So my partner works in human resources, and she always says, did you document it? That's a common saying that I hear. Have you documented, hey, we had this audit performed. Hey, this is how we brought in testers. This is, you know, every step that we took to show in good faith, we are trying to be accessible. And if there is a miss or something that is out of compliance, here is how we remediated it, or here is our plan for remediating it. And that's, the best that we can do is kind of show good intention and show a history of behavior of trying to be accessible and meeting up with standards. As I said earlier, you need to make sure that you are in compliance with your standards before you try looking at anything beyond that because of this exact reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the other thing that we commonly have conversations with our customers about, I guess when they're prospective customers, when they ask for this, is we'll talk a lot about budget and reality of quantities of content, and that perhaps they can't just rely on us. They might also have to do fixing. And then also there might be times where you make decisions to take content offline. I know that was a big thing that Harvard and MIT, because of the lawsuits related to lack of captions on their open videos, and they ended up deciding we're just going to take them down because we don't have the resources, either human or budgetary, to caption all of these videos. And so that's kind of a conversation that we'll have with customers. Like, it's very easy for us to ensure that the header and the footer and the sidebars and the main page template components are accessible. But if we're now talking about 8 or 9 years of once a week blog posting, right, where probably they weren't doing anything right, that's a whole different story. So I think that's a big thing that we talk about with them, is like setting the right bar on what is realistic and what makes sense. And there are exceptions with some of these laws for what they call, quote, archived content. But a lot of times people think content's important, and then you look at their Google Analytics and you're like, you know what? Literally no one has looked at this blog post from 5 years ago. No one has looked at it in the last 2 years. It has had zero hits. So would deleting it really be that bad? Probably not. So, yeah. Let's see. Someone said, how can accessibility SME, so subject matter expert, make sure that the accessibility is incorporated as part of in a sprint when there's lack of recourse? So I'm guessing on a product sprint, if maybe people are pushing back, how can they make sure that it doesn't just get pushed off and pushed off? Do you have tips?
Yeah, absolutely. This is my bread and butter, because this is what I do. It's figure out how to fit what is potentially a massive remedial kind of fixing of accessibility issues in already existing products and services into 2 week sprints, 3 week sprints, whatever your cadence may be. It really is dividing it into bite-sized chunks. You know what? For these 2 weeks, we are just going to be making sure all of our images have alt tags, or we are using the appropriate ARIA elements, maybe even smaller than that. Maybe we're just doing a ARIA role, you know, something very manageable within a 2 week period. And that's why I stressed this is little improvements over time. You can't fix an entire, 100,000 web page site in 2 weeks. But you can say, hey, in 2 weeks, I can get through the images, or I can get through color contrast ratios, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. We've been doing a lot, and Basecamp has a free ebook where they talk about their shape up method. Mm-hmm. And we've been doing that where we set sprints, and then in between the longer sprints, we have what we're calling cool off periods, where we do a lot of bug squashing, which isn't necessarily accessibility bugs, but just like random things, right? And I feel like figuring out how to map out your product in that way is very helpful. Like you're saying, like, what are our sprints? What can we fit in? And just really working on that buy-in, like you talked about in the presentation, and making sure everybody understands why it's important to not ignore those. I always say too, from a development standpoint, one of the first things I'll advise if we're consulting on like a plugin, because we do a lot of audits and consulting on WordPress plugins, is if your GitHub repo or wherever you're storing your code doesn't have a label for accessibility, that is the first step. You got to go create that so that you can start labeling your accessibility issues.
I do want to give a shout out. Nathan said in chat, for new features or pages, we include accessibility in the definition of done. Absolutely. I 100% agree. If you do not do this, you will just end up 6-12 months down the road repeating this cycle of, oh, we've got to go fix up our accessibility because we let it slide. Include it in your definition of done and don't let it pass until it's actually there.
Yeah, I love that. Someone said, do you have any suggestions for where to source testers with disabilities? Any business or consultants that you can recommend?
There are a number of services out there that will help source testers for you. I would say, honestly, it has been, in my experience, more beneficial to do testing with users of my product already and just putting out a call to my community of users to say, hey, we're looking to do some testing with someone who is, you know, since we do a lot of work with video, someone who is blind, someone who is deaf, you know, other visual and audio disabled people.
So you'll just send an email to your email list to see if there's anyone who is already in your customer base that matches that description?
Yes, I try to go inside before going out to somebody, because then in addition to working with the accessibility, I have to kind of orient them to working with our product, you know, and that's doing general usability testing rather than accessibility testing. And I'm trying to keep things focused on accessibility when I can, certainly.
Yeah, that's really smart. If people don't have them, I will give a quick shout out. We do user testing for a lot of different companies, and we have people who are blind on our team that can do user testing and access to some other people with disabilities. The other one that I would recommend is Knowbility, which is spelled with a K, Knowbility. They are a nonprofit organization in Austin. And I think Paula just posted the Knowbility.org link in the chat. They also have a program called AccessWorks that can connect you with people with disabilities and have a pretty big network. So that is also a good resource. Let's see. JC said, which accessibility practices are good foundations for people getting into HTML? When I teach about web accessibility, students often obsess about perfection. They obsess about using the perfect HTML tag or adding role attributes to everything. And this makes learning basic HTML overwhelming. I've compromised with stressful general semantic HTML. Oh, with stressing, sorry, general semantic HTML and headings. And I've hand-waved learning more specific HTML and ARIA roles, saying that they can learn more in practice. Do you have opinions about this?
Yes. I absolutely understand why you've stressed just general semantic and following kind of appropriate heading levels. It's going to follow the 80-20 rule. You're going to get the most bang for your buck by just following semantics. If you are, you know, a developer or learning developer who is trying to make sure that you are accessible, and hopefully everyone is, then you should be learning about ARIA. But I agree that it can be after you've learned kind of the semantics and fundamental basics. I think you need to be able to put it into real world practice, or if not necessarily real world practice, practical practice, where your ARIA role is shown to have a direct impact on, you know, something. So run your site through a speech, you know, a screen reader, just so they hear what that sounds like and they understand why an ARIA role is important. You know, not saying you have to know all of the ARIA roles right now, but understand what they are and why they're important at a basic level, I guess, would be a good starting place.
Mm-hmm. And I would point students to Mozilla developer documentation. I feel like they have some of the best documentation on ARIA and how to do things from an accessibility perspective. So this might be sort of a quick, there's two questions related to testing. I'm going to answer what I think is the fast one first. So Godwin asked, what are some of the tools that are out there that we can use for automated testing? Do you have a few that you like or want to shout out?
Yeah, I mean, I always recommend the kind of standard panel of NVDA, JAWS, VoiceOver on Apple, as, you know, your quick sanity checks for automated testing.
Screen reader.
Yeah, for screen reader, sorry. For automated testing, I currently use a tool called Total Validator, mostly because it also offers a command line interface, so I can incorporate that into our CI pipeline. But there are many, many, many different tools out there that will perform kind of the automated testing that is a good first step.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think if someone's just getting started, a common one that a lot of people use is the Wave browser extension, or Axe is another browser extension. Of course, we make our accessibility checker if you have a WordPress website for automated testing. And there's a lot of like little browser extensions that can do different things that are helpful. Like I have one that helps me find landmark regions on a page. So there's maybe a longer question of Lily asked, can you, a question sort of about what manual testing focuses on. Could you briefly sort of outline things that you look for when you do manual testing?
Yeah, so this very much ties into my background in user research. I always come in very task or workflow focused. I say, you know, we really, you know, maybe it's been a little while, or maybe we have changed something, or we're adding a net new capability. We need to test that workflow with our users. So, for example, one thing that I'm working on right now is adding better support for multiple audio tracks during video playback to allow users to select that. I'm running testing right now with users and basically giving them a script and saying, hey, here's what I would like you to do. Please talk through out loud what you're thinking and feeling as you're doing that. That's very much UX research focused, but I am still able to observe and, you know, hear their kind of thoughts about how they feel when they are doing that specific task. So I keep it task or workflow focused.
Mm-hmm. For user testing. So you'd say something like, find the video on this page and turn on the audio description. And then you'd sort of watch them try to accomplish that task and listen to what they see and observe where they get hung up.
Yep. So I would do that. I would go a step further and say, tell me about what you think about, this particular piece of content and the audio description, because, you know, I'm also evaluating, you know, did our audio description track actually deliver what we needed to deliver? You know, when I'm evaluating the accessibility, I may ask, would you expect this to be available in another language, or would it have helped you if this was available in another language? Because I know you are, you know, a native Spanish speaker or something along those lines. Mm-hmm. You know, trying to approach from multiple angles. Really, the question is, what's going to make this easiest for you and help you understand the content the best?
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. And I think user testing it's interesting because you get a lot of different feedback from it, but it probably really is the most authentic. I think as a web professional, I don't know if you want to provide any other thoughts on just like what we could do for manual testing, or I could give a short summary. I think we also have documentation on this in Accessibility Checker. Maybe we could grab the link. But do you want to talk about some things you might look for if you were testing?
Yeah, I always do a quick sanity check on screen readers, do a quick sanity check on there are like 14 different specific elements that I check. And I'm not going to be able to remember all of them off the top of my head. But, you know, I am checking some of the, you know, basic weak egg criteria. Are my color contrast ratios okay? Are my images alt? You know, do I have an alt text for my images? Do my videos all have captions? Can I control the playback speed of my videos? You know, a number of enhancements to make sure that, you know, just the basic expectations are being met. I can't tell you the number of times we roll out, you know, a new page and we're working on it and I run it through screen reader. And I'm like, even at, you know, 1x speed rather than some of the speeds that I've seen my testers do, I'm like, oh, that's not right. We missed something. Let's go look at what we missed. You know, it's mm-hmm. it's a quick sanity check more than anything.
Yeah, I like you mentioned like playback, and I think the literal on that is if you didn't have a mouse, could you still do everything on the website with a keyboard?
Yes. Yep. Which navigation is one of my 14 points that I check.
Yeah, it's almost. I think surprising sometimes to people that are getting into accessibility or just learning about it in the first hand that you don't actually have to be an expert to test that. As long as you've got a tab key and you know how to push it, you can start to figure out, you know, can I move around? Can I see where I am on the page? All of this stuff, which an automated tool can't really check.
Yeah.
So some of them can highlight tab stops, but a person still has to look at it to see if something was missed. So yeah. David had an interesting scenario. David said, let's say you have three vendors that supply an online banking platform and two of the three vendors have some understanding of digital accessibility. However, the company is leaning towards the third vendor that does not have an accessibility program, but offers all the quote, cool bells and whistles that customers would want. How do you influence the company to select one of the two vendors that have an accessibility program?
Again, it's going to depend. I have risen in my career to being a director. So now I have a little bit more ability to put my thumb on the scale and influence things. But if you are earlier in your career or you have a role where you're not in leadership necessarily, it can be hard to influence that. And I think you absolutely should be trying to influence this. And that's one of the reasons why I love to see VPAT documentation from vendors. If they have even that, it shows that they are thinking about accessibility, and it's going to show the good, the bad, and the ugly of where they're at with all of the criteria. You can use that as your evidence. Like, hey, again, you don't always want to use accessibility as avoiding a negative consequence, but hey, this banking software that we're looking at, it's not very accessible, or they're not showing us that it's accessible. We're opening ourselves up to lawsuits. I really think it would be better to go here. And at the end of the day, the best you can do is let your complaint be lodged, and you may not be able to change that decision, but you've done everything that you can.
Yeah. I think that there are some scenarios where fear works really well. And I think the banking industry is an industry where you could convince people with fear, because there is a lot of legislation around people with disabilities have to have equal access to their money. Full stop. Right. And so I think probably if the decision makers at a bank were not aware of all of the laws around banking and accessibility, or the court cases that going back even 20 years maybe to some of the work Lainey Feingold did with getting headphone jacks added to ATMs, I think that probably would be where I would start, to be honest, which I would just be like what you said. Vendors one and two have clear programs and have put effort in. Vendor three is not, and look at the laws that apply to our, you know. So I think it's a cost thing too, because if you went with vendor three because you like the quote bells and whistles, that might be possible, but then you might need to add costs to remediate things before you can launch. So Maybe it would be less expensive to go with the other vendors that have already put some effort in. Let's see, we have about 15 minutes left. So maybe we'll see what we can do. I think we should be able to wrap through these. Emmy said, when accessibility issues, sorry, hold on one second. I need to read this a little bit. I think this is a little bit related maybe to what we already talked on. How do I get executive buy-in? Do you have anything else to add beyond what we've already said about maybe using fear or loss?
Yeah, I would say get any foothold you can. And if you have to do that through fear and saying, like, we don't want to be sued, take it and run. Hopefully you can show the benefits in a positive way that, hey, you know, this is actually driving innovation. This is creating more customer loyalty. This is, you know, showing us as a company or an organization that has empathy and that has market value. It can be very hard to translate that into real dollars and cents. And sometimes that's what you have to do. But anything that you can do to try to improve, even if you say, hey, can you give me, you know, $100, $500, something, you could get an automated testing tool, and that will hopefully help make things better. You know, if you can say, can you give me some token amount of support to try to do this? Because it's not that they don't want to be accessible. I've yet to encounter someone who's like, no, I'm opposed to the concept of accessibility. It's that they think it's going to take too much time or too much money that they don't have. So trying to get some minimum amount from them and then turning that into a success and building from there.
Yeah, I like that. I think connecting it to key performance indicators, so KPIs, if the company has that, if you can say this is in support of this KPI, that might be motivational for executives. I think on that same note, there's a question here about creatives. And people often see creative and accessibility as opposites. Do you have any thoughts or responses for that sort of objection? So it's not about budget. It's not about time. It's that accessibility limits our creativity.
And this is kind of striking right to my core as, you know, a former UX designer. I will answer honestly. Sometimes creativity should be limited. When it comes to product design, website design, your users are not there because you have a pretty design. Your users are there to accomplish a specific task, to do a certain thing. And if they can't do that because of your pretty design, then you failed. You need to have a functional thing. Something that I reiterate over and over to my teams is content is king. Why are they there? For the content, not for the design. You should absolutely have design because design can help improve your accessibility. It can help draw attention, but having pretty design for pretty design's sake when it sacrifices usability and accessibility, no, I don't think that's the right answer.
I could not give a better answer to that than what you just gave. That was great. Nathan has sort of a technical question. I don't know if you know the answer to this. I don't. Nathan says, we're looking to automate screen reader testing like we would with a unit test. We've defined a piece of HTML content that is somewhat complex, and we want to ensure that in the future we don't accidentally break the way the screen reader reads. Are you aware of any tools to accomplish something like that?
I am not aware. I guess the closest thing I would say is I have seen some work with AI to try to be a more robust automated tester and gets into more things like being able to automate screen reading testing. That being said, I don't think the capabilities are truly there yet with enough accuracy. I think absolutely have your automated tests, have them run as part of your pipeline, because it's always good to know if you forgot something unintentionally in your development. But there's always going to be a need for just a quick sanity test. It should be part of your, as we mentioned, part of your definition of done, to have your developer run one screen reader test before they're signing off on their work being complete. It doesn't have to be, hey, we're going to test with JAWS and NVDA and VoiceOver on Apple and. Just do one as a sanity check.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I know we've done some experimentation with Puppeteer to automate clicks and testing user interaction that way, but I've never heard of anyone doing it with a screen reader.
So. Yeah, I've seen some efforts into automating the testing of the keyboard navigability, because that is much more objective rather than subjective. But yeah, screen readers is very hard because hearing content out loud and comprehending the content and knowing the context of it is not something I've seen an automated test do well.
Yeah. So I'm making something up here, but this is how I'm envisioning that this might work, which is that if you have a component and you know how it's supposed to sound already with NVDA, you would know this is the exact script that I expect NVDA to read out. If you could code something that, you know, renders the component or interacts with the component or whatever that is with, let's say, Puppeteer, with NVDA, if you're able to support that, you could then get like the speech viewer, the text script of what NVDA read, and compare it to the approved script, and then flag if it doesn't match exactly. I don't know if there's a tool that exists for this. Maybe this is a product someone needs to build. But that's how I think you could maybe automate this, but you'd still have to feed it in. This is the exact thing I expect.
Yeah. Right. And with large language models, you could build some fuzziness into that. That's like, are you close to it? And then it's probably okay. You know, for an automated test, I still wouldn't be entirely reliant on it, honestly. Until I'm shown 100% accuracy,
many times
I'm a bit skeptical. That being said, Absolutely. I think we should be looking into it. If there are ways that we can do more automated testing, it's going to improve accessibility for everyone. So I'm fully in support of it. I just am a bit skeptical that we're there right now. So as I said during my slides, if you do come up with it, let me know, because I would gladly incorporate that into my own procedures.
Software product idea for all of our viewers. This has been phenomenal. I really appreciate you sticking around and giving so many wonderful answers to all of the questions. Thank you to everyone who submitted great questions and the great conversation in the chat. Chris, where can people follow up with you if they want to get in touch?
They can reach out to me. We were talking about this before we really got started. Twitter, I am not on anymore. So I am on Threads. You can visit my website, which is just chrisschultens.com, and reach out through there. I am on LinkedIn. A lot of the usual suspects, you can find me, certainly.
Great. Well, thank you so much. Everybody, please come back in 2 weeks, as long as it's not the middle of the night for all of our European friends, to hear more about digital accessibility law from Richard Hunt. And in the meantime, we'll see y'all online. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Accessibility Craft. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe in your podcast app to get notified when future episodes release. You can find Accessibility Craft on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and more. And if building accessibility awareness is important to you, please consider rating Accessibility Craft 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. Accessibility Craft is produced by Equalize Digital and hosted by Amber Hines, Chris Hines, and Steve Jones. Steve Jones composed our theme music. Learn how we help make thousands of WordPress websites more accessible at equalizedigital.com.